listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. Welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Monday, September 26th, actually a reading of the Sunday, September 25th, 2022 paper. Support for this reading comes from the DuPaco R.W. Hafer Foundation. We're
Georgianne
and Myra, and here is our first story.
Talking point, cell phones in classrooms. Tri-state schools implement their own strategies regarding students and devices. By Elizabeth Kelsey. Cynthia Lacey admits that she was a bit nervous about implementing a new district-wide policy in southwestern Wisconsin school district this fall. While the district's decision to go phone-free didn't mean cell phones would be banned from school, she anticipated plenty of disgruntled students once they learned that they could no longer use their phones during the school day. "We kind of wavered, like, do we really want to take on this beast? But it really wasn't the beast that we thought it would be," said Lacey, principal of Southwestern Middle and High School in Hazel Green. "I thought that there'd be more pushback from the kids, but there really hasn't been much. That's come across my desk. The district's decision to prohibit the use of phones during the school day is unique among area districts, which utilize a variety of policies surrounding the devices. Many districts allow phone usage during passing time, but forbid it while students are in class, although enforcement can be a challenge. It's a battle like anything," said Jeff Recker, principal of Bellevue, Iowa Middle and High School. "In years past, there were other classroom distractions, but I'll be honest, phones are much more of an issue than things in the past, and that's why it's a concern." Limiting access. Lacey said Southwestern officials pursued a phone-free policy after noticing students spending increased amounts of time on the devices during school rather than engaging with peers. She said the issue of ongoing online bullying also played a role. Our biggest thing was just the social and emotional well-being of our students. She said, "There's a lot of research that cell phones are not always good for the developing brain, and we really want our kids to get back to talking face-to-face and interacting in person rather than through a screen." Platteville High School this fall also implemented a new policy requiring students to deposit their phones in holders upon entering each classroom. Principal Jacob Crace said the students collect the phones on the way out and are allowed to use them between classes and at lunch. Crace said that at the end of the last school year, teachers reported cell phones were becoming more and more of a distraction for students in classes. Administrative staff also enacted the policy to promote positive brain health and critical thinking skills. "There's a strong correlation between phone policies that really are limited and increased academic success," he said, noting that district staff researched other Wisconsin schools' phone policies. One school said it was an equivalent of adding an extra 5 days onto the school year. At East Dubuque, Illinois Junior High and High School, a longstanding policy prohibited a phone usage during class became more relaxed during the COVID-19 pandemic and remote and hybrid learning, according to Principal Darren Sirianni. "This year, it's made a concerted effort that we are really going to be enforcing these policies that have always been in place," he said later. "Many of the discipline issues have been dealing with over the past year were directly as a result of cell phones. Setting expectations. Students at Mazzucchelli Catholic Middle School in Dubuque are not allowed to access their phones and at any time during the school day unless a teacher chooses to allow phones as part of a lesson. Wallert Catholic High School, however, follows what Principal Doug Varley termed a passive permission system, where students can use phones at any time, but mind must be put them away immediately when told to do so by a staff member. There's no sneakiness involved because they are allowed to take them, Varley said. If they were told they couldn't use them, it would become a matter of trying to get away with it. That does work pretty well. At Dubuque Senior High, Principal Brian Howe said students can use phones during lunch and passing time, but not during classes, unless a teacher chooses to utilize them for an educational activity. He said setting clear expectations is key, but he acknowledged that students bend the rules. It has the opportunity to provide a disruption if students allow it to, and too many students allow that to be a disruption. Sometimes when the phone is close and they have the need to be in the know, it's hard for them to put that away, even when it's for 45 minutes in a class period. The place for phones. Western Dubuque High School principal Jake Feldman said the school currently lets teachers decide when phones can be used during class because the devices can serve as a tool for activities such as taking photos for a project. However, during the COVID-19 pandemic, the school launched a one-to-one technology program, and Feldman said the staff now are questioning the place for phones in classroom. Let's educate our kids on when it's appropriate time to use technology and not appropriate, because they're going to use this for the rest of their life, and particularly in the workplace, Feldman said.
No vacancy. Across the tri-state area, high demand hits homeless shelters. Just before 6 p.m. September 13th, Brian Bower walked into the second floor dining hall of the Dubuque Rescue Mission and asked for a place to stay for the night. He was incredulous after learning how few beds the facility has, 18 in all, and he was informed that they were all full for the night, with 6 people already on the waiting list. Bower, a middle-aged, recently employed sales executive with 2 degrees from Loras College and 300-odd LinkedIn connections, was left standing in the dining hall, wondering where he would sleep that night. For the rescue mission, being full with a waiting list wasn't unusual. And it wasn't unusual for there to be more people sleeping in the greenhouse out back. 2 were there that week. Nor had it been unusual to find more people sleeping in the city parking garage nearby, though city staff have ramped up efforts to curtail that practice. It wasn't even unusual that the number of people on the waiting list for those 18 beds had doubled up 3 days later. Homeless shelters and related services across the tri-state area have reported a surge in demand in the recent months that often outpaces available resources. There also is an indication that the number of unhoused people nationally might continue to grow in the next year. Experts point to a wide range of factors causing the upswell, the most preeminent being mental health issues, the rising cost of housing across the area, and the system shock of the COVID-19 pandemic to homeless services locally and nationwide. But local agencies continue to work to meet the need, with several poised to open additional shelter space. In recent months, officials at local homeless shelters have seen demand for beds consistently outpace supply. "We're just busy all the time," said Heather Lugrain, program manager at Women and Children's Shelter Service Opening Doors. An Opening Doors principal intake facility, The Emergency and Extended Stay Teresa Shelter, the nonprofit, has served 55 to 60 people per month since June. The facility in July hit its capacity for the first time since the pandemic. "We have every single bed full right now," LaGrange said. "Every time a bed is available, it becomes unavailable." In 20 and 21, LaGrange said, the shelter facility recorded cumulative totals of less than 6,000 bed nights per year. By the end of August in 2022, the yearly total already stood at 6,805 bed nights. At one point, staff squeezed an extra bed frame and mattress onto the shelter's already cramped floor for a mother with two children. Almost Home, a former men's shelter that reopens on Monday, September 26, as Dubuque's first shelter catering to men with children, has received 15 calls a week since it closed in spring. "We're getting so many calls, for lack of a better word, like a reservation," said Executive Director Gren Kirchhoff. "They're calling ahead for the winter. They're from all over the state, from Wisconsin and Illinois." When it opens, Almost Home will take in two families, two fathers with up to three children each, with plans to start construction in October on space for another three families. Almost Home already has 15 candidates for space lined up, referred to them from various social service agencies. And that's just the ones who qualify. Kirchhoff has gotten calls from hospital discharge planners, jails, and prisons, as well as referrals from customers at the Open Closet clothing giveaway the shelter also runs. When there wasn't space for Brian Rohr to sleep at the Dubuque Rescue Mission on September 13th, his girlfriend got him a hotel room. But contrary to his belief, his background wouldn't necessarily have made him unique among those staying at the mission. Plenty of people from all different backgrounds find themselves in shelters. "We've had firemen, we've had police officers, we've had attorneys," said Rescue Mission Administrator Jeff Lenhart. "People from all walks of life." And occupants of shelter facilities represent only a portion of those struggling with housing insecurity. People enter homeless shelters for a vast number of reasons, but area providers point to several common factors. Regular issues that can interfere with finding housing can include having an eviction or criminal conviction that shows up on a background check. Substance abuse disorders can lead to people being denied housing by public housing authorities. And mental health looms large, a major factor for the most recently homeless. Homelessness is closely correlated with mental health issues. For example, surveys conducted this year showed about 25% of the homeless in the greater Los Angeles areas were dealing with serious mental illness. Local expansions. Local shelter services are moving to expand their space. Once its renovation is complete, Almost Home's new shelter in Dubuque will able to house up to 20 people in families of four. Meanwhile, Dubuque Rescue Mission will house another 20 people overnight in the site of the former Dubuque Food Pantry, which the shelter is converting into a heating center for the winter, though it's a temporary space that will not be used in the warmer months. Officials from Hawkeye Area Community Action Program, the community action agency with a coverage area that includes Dubuque, Delaware, Jackson, and Jones counties, have expressed interest in purchasing and rehabilitating local housing for families in poverty. The agency already has done so in Benton, Johnson, Linn, and Washington counties. CEO Jane Drapeau wrote in an email that the agency hopes to become an affordable housing provider for the Dubuque community at some point in the future. Nationally, the Department of Housing and Urban Development has set aside $54.5 million for area continuums of care to combat rural homelessness. Reviving certain pandemic-era programs such as the Motel Voucher Program could also help address the surge. Many municipalities retained their pandemic-era homeless programs, buying defunct hotels to convert into additional shelter space. It was those that hadn't that were seeing more homelessness. What is shown is that what we've always said, when you provide enough resources, we can address these numbers in a substantive way, Whitehead said.
Dubuque rally protests gun rights amendment. The measure would add the right to keep and bear arms to Iowa's state constitution and subject restrictions to strict scrutiny. When couple Kate Parks and Todd Schmidt of Dubuque learned of the shootings at Maquoketa Caves State Park in July, they were shocked. When they learned hours later that the victims were close family members, they were devastated. Tyler and Sarah Schmidt and their six-year-old daughter Lula, all of Cedar Falls, were shot and killed July 22nd at their campsite. Tyler Schmidt was Todd Schmidt's cousin. We thought, how could this possibly be real? How can it happen to a beautiful sanctuary like this? And how could something like that happen to them? Said Kate Parks, president of the Dubuque Community School Board. That's the story she shared Saturday with a crowd of around 60 people gathered outside Dubuque Dream Center to oppose a controversial firearms amendment that will appear on November 8th ballot. If passed, the measure would add the right to keep and bear arms to Iowa's state constitution, as well as require any gun restriction be subject to strict scrutiny, the highest standards of judicial review. Opponents argue the amendment could make it harder to pass a common sense gun control measures and put public service at risk, while those in support of the measure say the move is necessary to protect Iowan gun rights from infringement. Many people wore orange at the Dubuque event, the color associated with the movement to eradicate gun violence. Ahead of the speeches, people could write their reason for attending on a small squares of paper that were being passed around, hung around the space. Beth Wright said that she attended because she worries for kids facing the gun violence in schools. This year, there have been 30 school shootings that resulted in injuries or death, including a mass shooting in Uvalde, Texas, that killed 21 people. We shouldn't be afraid to go to work or school, said Wright, a paraeducator at Prescott Elementary. I'm not necessarily against guns, but we need better protections. Opponents' biggest qualms with the ballot measure is the requirement that gun laws be subject to strict scrutiny, which they say goes above and beyond the requirements of the Second Amendment. Iowa Firearms Coalition board member Richard Rogers said the strict scrutiny issue is functionally moot. However, after a certain Supreme Court ruling that requires all gun laws adhere to America's historical tradition of firearm regulation, a standard Roger considers as strong or stronger than strict scrutiny. He also pointed out that Iowa is one of the six states without firearm protections in its state constitution, and says passage of the amendment is essential to protecting Iowans' gun rights. Our opponents say this is reckless amendment, but what reckless about liberty? Rogers said when reaching ahead of the event. The right to bear arms is a fundamental right, as the Supreme Court has repeatedly recognized. March for Our Lives, Iowa co-director and event speaker Esha Bowler recognized the ruling Saturday, but said its legal requirements are not as extension or restrictive as though necessitated under strict scrutiny. Strict scrutiny is several steps up from the requirements of the Second Amendment, said Bowler. 17. The proposed Iowa measure would make it extremely hard to pass any kind of gun violence protection policy. Parks also expressed concern over the strict scrutiny requirement when she said she made it harder to prevent tragedies like the one that hit her family. She said she hoped her family's story would inspire people to vote against the amendment. Tyler and Sarah were wonderful people with great parents, she said, and they cared about others, and they would speak out against this measure if they were here to do so.
Marshallese community gathers for Monif Day. Celebration of cultural heritage is held for the first time in Dubuque. The weather at Jackson Park on Saturday, overcast, breezy, and in the high 50s, was a far cry from the humid 80 degrees of the Marshall Islands capital, Majuro, that day, but Dubuque's Marshallese community persisted in a first-time cultural celebration. Natives of the Marshall Islands celebrate Monif Day, an annual festival held on the last Friday of September. It's the first time the event has been hosted in Dubuque, coordinator Ayuko Mann said. The Jackson Park Festival was hosted by Monsoon Asian and Pacific Islanders in Solidarity, who serve victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, and sex trafficking throughout Iowa's Asian American and Pacific Islander communities. Mann, who speaks both English and Marshallese, works on outreach and advocacy for the group. I'm excited because we've been trying to do this specific event for a while in Dubuque, Mann said. As we're living in a diverse city community, it's necessary to show who we are and where we come from and how we celebrate our traditions. This year's celebration, Mann said, is only a mini festival on the islands. The event usually is preceded by a week of celebration known as Lutak Koban Alili, literally, pour out the valuable contents of the basket. Essentially, it's Marshallese Spirit Week, Mann said. Island schools will host special days like Flag Day, where students dress up in the blue, orange, and white of the Marshallese flag, and Lei Day, where they wear the necklaces of flowers and other traditional ornaments. At the park, organizers dished out barbecued chicken, balls of sugared coconut called mitoma, a thick custard-like sweet drink called lukor, and jekmai, a yellow-hued drink made from the boiled sap of coconut trees. Pastor Anthony Watak confided the sap tasted better fresh, but did not keep well. After remarks from community leaders like Maita Jolay, Mon, and two chiefs, Gerard Watak and Helterra Hermios, festivities included traditional dances by both youth and adult community members and games including juggling, weaving, and musical chairs. Guests were greeted with marmars, necklaces meant to resemble strings of polished stones, and could admire wall fixtures, pictures, and even purses made of coconut palm fronds, amim nono. Organizers wore blue-hued Hawaiian shirts, often under heavy coats. Some women wore dresses in blue, orange, and white, and headbands made of the pandanus tree, known as wut belbel. This is most popular with Marshallese women, Adna Jake said. We love to wear it. Mound said it was an opportunity for Dubuque Marshallese to showcase their culture to their peers. It's a good chance for our friends and neighbors who know who we are, she said. I get asked, where are the Marshall Islands? Who are the Marshallese? So this is a good chance to show that and what we value. It was also an opportunity for some of the Marshallese community's younger members to connect with their culture. Mon said even some members of her planning committee didn't know the Marshallese term for wet belbel.
We're moving into opinion now. The Dream Center, Fulton Great Fit. Two recent decisions by a pair of local government entities open a new chapter for an old facility that could bring monumental change to an agency dramatically impacting the lives of young people. It's the stuff that dreams are made of. First, Dubuque Community School Board members voted last week to sell the former Fulton Elementary School to Dubuque Dream Center, which plans to renovate the building and use it as a second operational site. Second, Dubuque City Council members supported that vision by providing the Dubuque Dream Center with $300,000 for the purchase and rehabilitation of the building. In the words of school board member Jim Prohaska, "I can't think of a more worthy organization to have than that property. The Dubuque nonprofit offers a variety of youth programs that provide mentoring, arts and athletic opportunities, career development, and academic assistance. Dream Center's officials said that having Fulton as a second operational site will let them significantly increase the number of students they serve, as the center currently has more than 100 students on a waiting list. Though the $500,000 bid by the Dream Center came in under $890,000 assessment of Fulton, it is hard to imagine a better outcome and use for this space. Fulton long served as the heart of the North End neighborhood in which it resides. As the Dream Center locale, the heart continues to beat. For kids it currently serves, the Dream Center provides more than academic education, although that's a big part of it. Students are learning about the things that are spark their interest: basketball, music, dance. They're learning discipline and building character. From humble beginnings and nearly a decade ago, the Dream Center has grown into a program serving 150-plus students with lofty goals, starting with improved student achievement. Tied to that goal are other standards involving the regular school day, including improved behavior, character development, and attendance. The Dream Center participants work on academics with the help of key volunteers, many of them teachers. Then they practice an activity such as basketball, piano, or choir. Students even can get a hot meal and a ride home. The Dream Center fills a need in our community that many Dubuquers know little about. Now, with the combined decisions by school districts and city elected officials, another part of its story can begin. It just feels right to know that the Fulton Building, home to generations of students, will provide a special space for children for years to come.
You are listening to the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Your readers are
Georgianne
and Myra. If you have any comments on this or any IRIS program, please call 243-6833 or toll free at 877-404-4747. And don't forget, this and many other IRIS programs are available from our website at iowaradioreading.org. Now we return to the Telegraph Herald. And we pick up in the opinion section with letters to the editor. Kirkendall, A Leader Invested in Community by Katie Kopp, Stone Valley Drive, Dubuque. I am writing in support of Richard Kirkendall's candidacy for county attorney. I have known Richard for most of my life and have had the privilege of watching him grow from that really smart guy I went to high school with into an outstanding attorney. He is the only candidate running with experience prosecuting criminal cases. He is running without a political party, even though being independent can be a bit of an uphill battle, because his goal is to run the county attorney's office without partisan influence, truly seeking justice for all. His foundational experience as an Army JAG officer prepared him not only to prosecute cases, but also to be a leader. Parentheses. Recent events have certainly highlighted how terribly things can go wrong when the county attorney is not prepared to manage a team. Richard is a native Dubuquer who invests in his community. He plays in the orchestra, is involved in parish council, and playing music at Mass. attends local veteran events, invites neighbors to his annual Christkindl Market, and coaches children's soccer. When he says he cares about the safety of Dubuque County residents, he means it. His actions match his words, and that integrity is important to me. I strongly recommend voting Kirkendall for county attorney on November 8.
Continuing letters to the editor, candidates should vouch for election integrity. By Wayne Dimmer. As an elected official who has been part of the election process many times as a county trustee, school board member, county supervisor, and current soil and water commissioner, I put my trust in a free and fair election process. When you lose an election, you are to accept the results. When all the mistrust in our election process in this country, how can we ever have another fair election in 2022 and beyond if we are unwilling to accept the results of that election? 2 years after our last election, there had been no valid proof, only theories that the election was stolen. I would like to challenge all of our local, state, and federal elected officials to state in an editorial to newspapers in your district where they stand on the election process in this country. Many of you have been elected many times using the same election process, and no one has ever questioned that the process was unfair, as long as you won. The election process is now only questioned when someone loses. So anyone who is running for a public election in November 8, 2022, I challenge you to tell the public your view on whether our elections have been and will continue to be fair and free. I hope voters will look for your response and vote accordingly. My name is on the ballot, and I support your election process. So if you lose, accept the results and don't blame the election process. By Wayne Dimmer.
Reproductive rights at risk in this election season. Michelle Beschen, Richard Rhodes, Dubuque. The Supreme Court's overturning of Roe v. Wade has already made abortion a crime in over a dozen states. For 50 years, American women have had the constitutional right to decide for themselves whether or not to end a pregnancy without fear of persecution or penalty. Make no mistake about what this bill in the Senate is. It is a national abortion ban. Should anti-abortion politicians gain power in Congress, they will seek to ban abortion in every state of the country. End of story. The chaos, confusion, and devastation we are now seeing across the country is exactly the environment anti-abortion lawmakers have worked for decades to create, and they now want to bring to every state in the nation. This has never been about states' rights. This is about control. Lawmakers hostile to reproductive rights want to control our bodies, lives, and futures as means to hold on to their power. And they won't stop until abortion is banned across the country. The American people overwhelmingly support access to safe, legal abortion and are furious at the lawmakers imposing abortion bans and interfering with their personal health care decisions. We need to hold these anti-abortion politicians to account at the ballot box in November.
Amish proud to pay fair share of taxes. By Amos Christener. This is a breakdown of taxes I paid in 2021. U.S. Treasury, $17,798. State income tax, $8,454. Real estate, $22,309. Roughly 50% of this went to our public schools. However, Amish people pay to educate their own. I also collect sales tax on three businesses, Hartwick General, Hartwick Hardware, and Christener Supply. Last year, I sent $260,156 in sales tax generated from your support, and $38,156 for local school taxes. This shows you need to shop locally so tax dollars stay in Iowa. I am not disappointed by the taxes I pay, as we are living in the greatest country on earth and probably best state in the Union. Delaware County is doing a great job for the Amish, and this is one of the few places we can make our own choice to live the American dream. Okay. We now turn to the obituaries. Walter Paisley III, from Bankston, Iowa. Walter William Paisley III, or Wally as he was known to everyone that loved him, 75, of Bankston, Iowa, passed away on Wednesday, September 21st, at Mercy One Medical Center in Dubuque after a hard-fought battle with ischemic heart disease brought on by Agent Orange exposure. Visitation for Wally will be held 4 to 7 on Tuesday, September 27th at Rife Funeral Parlor in Epworth, Iowa. The prayer service will be held at 3:30 and the rosary said at 6:30 p.m. Mass of Christian burial will be at 10:30 Wednesday at St. Clement's Catholic Church in Bankston, Iowa. The burial will follow in St. Clement's Cemetery, full military honors afforded by the Marine Corps Honor Guard. Wally also will be escorted by the Dubuque Fire Department Honor Guard. The Dubuque Fire Department will have the striking of the bells ceremony. He was born in October 31st, 1946, in Riverside, California, the son of Walter Williams and Marlene Paisley II. He enlisted in the Naval Corps and then transferred to the Marine Corps. He was enlisted from September 1965 to August 69. He spent the majority of his enlisted fighting in the Vietnam War and earning the Purple Heart and many other medals of bravery. Upon his return, he traveled around the United States, attending colleges and working on earning his degree. He met Jean Swoboda in Wayne, Nebraska, in May 6, 1972. He was united in marriage to her in Wahoo, Nebraska. They moved to Dubuque, Iowa, and Wally started his career within the Dubuque Fire Department. He loved his friends. He had a quick smile and kind word for everyone. He would not hesitate to tell you that you were being a dumbass. He was the first to offer help and the last to leave. It was common for him to cruise the neighborhood, stopping to chat and checking in on everyone. Wally was an avid reader and lifelong learner. He passed on his love of reading and learning to his children and grandchildren. He loved politics and could talk for hours on the Second Amendment. He was proud to be a United States Marine, Semper Fi. He loved his grandchildren, and he loved being a grandpa. He was so proud of everything that they accomplished and enjoyed teaching them everything he could. His highlights were having them visit and spending time outdoors with them. He was always divulging some kind of wisdom randomly. His popular topics were music and history. Dad, we love you. We miss you. We make sure that the one ringer when you get where you're going is the way that you made it. Love and miss you forever.
Brian S. Shigfry. Brian Stephen Shigfry, 45, of Dubuque, passed away unexpectedly on Thursday, September 22nd. Visitation will be from 3 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, September 28th, in the social space at Church of the Resurrection. There will be a prayer service at 7 p.m. Visitation will continue Thursday, September 29th, at 10:30 until the 11 a.m. Mass of Christian Burial. Mass will be live-streamed. Interment will be at Mount Olivet Cemetery. Arrangements entrusted to Eaglehoff, Siegert, and Caspert Funeral Home and Crematory. Brian was born January 20th, 1977, in Dubuque, the son of Stephen and Kathleen LoBianco Shigfry. He graduated from Dubuque Senior High School with the class of 1995. After high school, Brian worked at Valet Foods and then at John Deere Dubuque Works, where he was currently employed. He was a member of UAW Local 94. In his younger years, Brian enjoyed playing soccer and was an avid Green Bay Packers fan. Brian always had a smile and was a friend to everyone. He was generous and fun-loving, a big kid. He is survived by his daughters, Lily and Evelina Shigfry, his parents, Steve and Kathy Shigfry, and his sister, Amy Mills, his fiancée, Lindsay Streif, his nieces and nephews, many cousins, and his best buddies, his dogs. Brian was preceded in death by his paternal grandparents, Ray and Phyllis Shigfry, his maternal grandparents, Dan and Mary LoBianco, uncles and aunts, Deacon Tim and Teresa LoBianco, Joe and Tracy LoBianco, and Lisa LoBianco. Family would like to thank all the first responders, especially the Dubuque Police Department, for all their help and kindness.
David Orr, Key West, Iowa. David Orr, 80, of Key West, Iowa, formerly of Des Moines, Iowa, passed away on Wednesday, September 21st, at home with his wife by his side. In keeping with David's wishes, no memorial service will be held. The Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory on Rockdale Road is assisting the family. David was born on January 5th, 1942, in Boscobel, Wisconsin, son of Evans and Lenise McFall Orr. He served in the United States Military Corps from February 68. On June 5th, he married Carol Northhouse in Lancaster, Wisconsin. He worked for Hawkeye Paving until his retirement. He enjoyed NASCAR races and the Green Bay Packers. He was survived by his wife, Carol, sisters Mary Ellen, Sharon Brookins, and Lenore Ashram, and brother Ronnie Orr. He was preceded in death by his parents, brother Dick, in-laws, and brothers-in-law Rick Northhouse and Arnold Brookins. The family would like to thank Hospice of Denver for their care and support, especially nurses Kelly and Angelia. In lieu of flowers, David Orr Memorial will be established. Memorials will be sent to Leonard Funeral Home in David's name.
Candy K. Brochud. Candy K. Brochud, age 44, of Oregon, Wisconsin, passed away peacefully at home on September 21, 2022, after a courageous battle with ovarian cancer. A public visitation will be held Wednesday, September 28, from 2 to 4, with service at 4 p.m., officiated by Pastor Jeff Vandenhovel at Messiah Lutheran Church in Madison. She will be laid to rest at Linwood Cemetery, 2736 Windsor Avenue, Dubuque, on Thursday, September 29th, with a graveside service at 11 a.m. Candy was born on December 27, 1977, in Dubuque, the daughter of Clarence Jr. and Jane Kaler Gents, and raised in nearby Durango. Candy graduated from Hempstead High School and proceeded to attend the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee School of Architecture and Urban Planning, where she received her Bachelor of Science and Master's degree in Architecture. It was here that Candy met her future husband, John. Candy and John reunited in marriage in Dubuque on September 7, 2002. Candy was a dedicated, loving wife and mother, homeschooling Juliana through middle school. She was an avid lover of nature, always making time to explore the outdoors. She incorporated organic living and nature into all aspects of her life. Candy was incredibly thoughtful and kind, always putting others before herself. She retained a relentless, optimistic outlook throughout her battle with cancer, never once complaining, and always bringing joy to everyone who loved and cared for her. Those left to cherish her eternal memory are her loving husband, John Brochud, and their daughter, Juliana, of Oregon, Mother Jane Jentz, Sisters Kelly Jentz, Ruff E. Jentz, all Ruff and Christy Kelly, and brothers Clarence C.J. Jentz of Dubuque, Iowa. Nieces, nephews, uncles and aunts, several cousins, and one very special cousin, Ken Jentz Jr. She was preceded in death by her father, Clarence, father-in-law, Bernie Bruchud, maternal grandparents, Rose and Dewey Kaler, maternal aunt, Viola Kaler, paternal grandparents, and aunts and uncles. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be gifted in Candy's name to Woodland Dunes Nature Center, founded by her father-in-law in Two Rivers, Wisconsin.
Robert L. Duster, 75, of Dubuque, died on Saturday, September 24th. The visitation will be held from 3 to 7, Wednesday, September 28th, at Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory on Rockdale Road, where services will follow. Christy L. Preby, Asbury, Iowa. Christy, 66, of Asbury, died on Wednesday, September 21st. Private services will be held. Tri-State Cremation Center of East Dubuque is assisting the family.
Billy L. Stant. Billy Lewis Stant, 75, of Dubuque, died Friday, September 23rd at Dubuque Specialty Care. Visitation will be from 9 to 10:15 a.m. Saturday, October 1st at First Presbyterian Church. The funeral services for Billy will be at 10:30 Saturday, October 1st at First Presbyterian Church. Burial will be in Linwood Cemetery in Dubuque. Full military honors will be rendered by the American Legion Post 96 and the Iowa Army National Guard. Billy was born February 4th, 1947 in Dubuque, son of Francis and Barbara Burkle Stant. On November 4th, 1972, he married Karen Ann Hahn in Dubuque. He was a 1965 graduate of Dubuque Senior High School and a U.S. Army veteran serving during the Vietnam War. He worked at John Deere Dubuque Works for 30 years. Billy was a lifelong member of First Presbyterian Church, where he served on the Board of Trustees as elder and sang in the choir with his wife. He was a member of the AmVets in Florida. An outdoorsman, he enjoyed hunting, fishing, and camping. He also enjoyed bowling and a good game of cards. Survivors include his wife, Karen, two sons, Paul Stant and Mark Stant, both of Dubuque, three grandsons, one sister, Sandy Spencer of Dubuque, and five nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his parents and one sister, Viola Belk. Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory is in charge of arrangements.
The funeral services. Willie Berger, Garber, Iowa. Visitation 4 to 7 on Monday, September 26. Leonard Miller Funeral Home, Edgewood. Service 10:30, Tuesday, September 27th, at St. John Congregational Church, Garber.
Mary P. Grady, Strawberry Point. Visitation 10 to 11 a.m., Tuesday, September 27, St. Patrick's Catholic Church, Monona. Mass of Christian Burial, 11 a.m., Tuesday, at the church.
Janice M. Hancock, Shellsburg, Wisconsin. Visitation 10 to 10:45, Saturday, October 1st. Centenary United Methodist Church, Shellsburg. Service 10:45, Saturday, at the church.
Eugene H. Reynolds, Potosi. Visitation 9 to 10:45 a.m., Tuesday, September 27th, at St. Thomas Catholic Church, Potosi. Mass of Christian Burial, 11 a.m., Tuesday, at the church.
Mary E. Seitz, Dyersville, Iowa. Visitation 2 to 7 today, Kramer Funeral Home, Dyersville. Mass of Christian Burial, 10:30 Monday, September 26th, at St. Francis Xavier Basilica in Dyersville.
Back to news. Difficult choices as state institutions close. Iowa plans to close Glenwood Resource Center, a state-run facility for people who have intellectual or developmental disabilities, by Tony Lays. Glenwood, Iowa. Mike Lee's way of life has faded away in most of the United States, and it soon will vanish from southwestern Iowa. Lee, 57, has spent 44 years at the Glenwood Resource Center, a state-run institution for people with intellectual or developmental disabilities. He has autism and epilepsy, and his parents decided when he was 13 that he needed the structure and constant oversight offered by a large facility. Theirs was a common decision at the time. It no longer is. The number of Americans living in such institutions has dropped more than 90% since the late 1960s. 17 states have closed all their large public institutions for people with disabilities. Just 5 states, Iowa, Nebraska, South Carolina, Utah, and Wyoming, haven't closed any, according to a University of Minnesota expert. Iowa announced in April that in 2024 it would shutter the Glenwood Resource Center, a sprawling campus near the state's western border. State leaders cited federal pressure to improve conditions for the facility's residents or place them elsewhere. Many of the remaining residents of such places have lived there for decades, leaving their families with wrenching choices when closure looms. Lee knows he will move soon, even if he doesn't understand the implications. His sister, Connie Bowen, broached the subject during a recent visit. She picked her brother up from the one-story house where he lives with several other residents on the institution's grounds and drove him to a nearby Pizza Hut for lunch. As he sipped on a root beer, she asked how he felt. "Does it make you sad or happy that you're leaving?" she said. "Happy. I'm happy," he replied. He said he is looking forward to a calmer life away from the institution, where he said other residents often become disruptive. Bowen, who is her brother's legal guardian, agrees in theory with the idea of caring for people with disabilities in homes or apartments. But like many other relatives of Glenwood Resource Center residents, the worries that the new arrangement may not be safe for people who have been institutionalized for decades. The Glenwood Resource Center, founded as an orphanage in the 1860s, housed more than 1,900 people at its peak in the 1950s. Now 134 people live there. Many residents face more hurdles than Lee does. Some can't speak. Many also have physical disabilities that make getting around difficult and can pose life-threatening risks. Some residents can become confused or agitated. Cheryl Larson, a University of Minnesota researcher who tracks institutional care for people with disabilities, said Iowa lags behind most other states in winding down such facilities. The number of Americans living in state-run institutions plummeted from 194,650 in 1967 to 17,596 in 2018, according to a recent paper that Larson helped write. The closures partly stemmed from the U.S. Supreme Court's 1999 decision, which held that Americans with disabilities have a right to live in the least restrictive setting that is practical. Like Glenwood, most state institutions opened more than a century ago, and they typically were constructed in rural areas. There was a movement to create a bucolic environment for individuals, said Mary Stowers, executive director of the National Association of State Directors of Developmental Disabilities Services. Many of the big institutions, including farms where residents helped grow their food. Conventional wisdom held that country life would be healthful. Now, Sowers said, we recognize that the larger settings really didn't wind up living up to that promise, and individuals are able to thrive more when they are able to live in communities. The future. The facility at Glenwood has nearly 470 workers, making it the largest employer in the area. Some may find new jobs in Omaha. A few may transfer to similar institutions. This brings us to the end of today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for September 26, paper of 25th, 2022. We're your readers,
Georgianne,
and Myra. Support for this reading comes from the DuPaco R.W. Hafer Foundation. The Telegraph Herald can be heard each weekday at 2 p.m. All programs heard on IRIS are intended solely for the blind and print handicapped. If you have any questions or comments on this or any IRIS program, please call our office toll-free at 877-404-4747. Thanks for listening.